The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to the History of Egypt podcast. Today, I have a special surprise. The Metropolitan Opera in New York is running a new production of Philip Glass's 1983 opera, Akhenaten. In a surprising bit of coincidence, the opera is running from November 8th to December 7th, and it just so happens to coincide with our exploration of Akhenaten and his wonderful reign. The production is led by Philippe McDermott, a well-respected stage director who has previously produced this opera in 2016 for the English National Opera. He has also led productions of Aida by Giuseppe Verdi, Così fan tutti by Mozart, A Midsummer Night's Dream by William Shakespeare, and The Addams Family musical. Needless to say, Mr. McDermott is well equipped to present this opera, and as you will hear from the cast, his directions have been invaluable in bringing Akhenaten to life. The opera is conducted by Karen Kamensek, who also conducted it in 2017, for which she won the Laurence Olivier Award for Best New Opera Production. The 2019 Met Opera season of Akhenaten promises to be a spectacular show, with virtuoso performances and costumes to die for. Notably, the production is running from November 8th to December 7th in New York. And if you can't make it to New York to see the performance in person, there will be cinema screenings of the opera recorded live in the forthcoming months. Now, as part of the preparations for the opera's debut, I was contacted by one of the performers, Zachary James, who plays Amunhotep III and the scribal narrator of the events. With Zachary's help and the generous support of the team at the Metropolitan Opera, we were able to arrange a roundtable interview with the four stars of this production. I'm pleased to present a discussion with Anthony Roth Costanzo, who plays Akhenaten, Janae Bridges, who plays Nefertiti, Dicila Laros' daughter, who plays Queen Ti, and Zachary, who plays Amunhotep III. Over the next hour or so, you will hear the performers break down their roles and discuss what makes Philip Glass's opera such a fascinating portrayal of this ancient and mysterious ruler. So without further ado, allow me to introduce Anthony Roth Costanzo, Janae Bridges, Dicila Laros' daughter, and Zachary James, the star players of Akhenaten, a Met opera production led by Philippe McDermott. My first guest is Anthony Roth Costanzo, who plays Akhenaten. Anthony Akhenaten, welcome to the History of Egypt podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining me. I'm excited to see the show when it's broadcast live, and I look forward to your performance. First up, is this your first time playing Akhenaten, or did you do the previous runs as well?
This is my fourth time, in fact. So we've done three rounds of this production, and each time I feel I've gotten deeper into both the history and my own interpretation of it.
Excellent. I think I saw some YouTube clips of your performance in London, and I really enjoyed it. So I'm excited to see the full show. So, Anthony, you're pretty familiar with musical Akhenaten now, or shall we say opera Akhenaten. In the opera specifically, not in history, who is your character musically, and what characteristics does he bring onto the stage?
I think musically, Akhenaten is someone who's trying to convey his very visionary beliefs, beliefs that we ascribe as monotheism, that he perhaps invented, and he wants to change the fabric of society and the way people think. And so the music is at times forceful and at times lyrical, depending on how he wants to convey these different ideas.
Okay. How, out of curiosity, how would he convey something like forcefulness through just his stage presence, perhaps.
So there's a scene in which he destroys the old order, and it's called the temple scene, and he goes into this temple and he destroys the old religion. And what Philip Glass does is write very percussively for the voice in a way which is almost impossible to sing. So we have to sing these repeated notes like ha 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 ha, and I see it almost as throwing little daggers or, you know, waging war with our voices. And it feels like that. It feels physical and strenuous, and it feels like we're running a marathon or something like that. So by the end of it, it feels that we've fought a battle, in fact. So Philip Glass uses endurance, uses the repetition, which is characteristic of his minimalism, to really convey everything in different ways. And the rhythm is key. You know, Philip Glass was inspired by Eastern music and Eastern rhythms. And so he uses different speeds and different rhythms within those speeds to convey different emotions.
Okay. So I imagine after a scene like that, you kind of come off the stage sort of drenched in sweat and wondering what you're doing.
Depending on how well it goes, hopefully we keep in our minds what we're doing. But it can be very disorienting, and you have to be really focused, and there's no way to learn it other than to repeat it as you would repeat a prayer or, you know, rehearse something over and over. And it took me 4 months to learn this one scene and to remember exactly how it went. It's very challenging.
Wow. So for the non-musically literate like myself and some of my audience, what kind does Akhenaten go through any sort of vocal or musical evolution through the performance or the runtime of the opera?
Interesting question. I think that Akhenaten is written for a countertenor, which is this male who sings in a female register. So if I were to sing a note, I would sound like a woman, and you'd be surprised. And so Philip Glass thought about writing it for a countertenor because he wanted to represent the ways in which Akhenaten was other and individual and different. But also contained within that is both the masculine and feminine. And so if Akhenaten, in fact, saw God as the unification of man and woman rather than one gender, this voice kind of perfectly embodies his ideal. And as the piece goes on, I feel the progression is that the vocalism kind of softens and it gets a little more sensual and perhaps you could even say feminine in the way that it's shaped. And so it represents to me Akhenaten's progression from a 17-year-old boy who takes the throne to these depictions we see of him in statues and in stella where you can see feminine attributes like breasts and hips and large lips. So we have the progression from male to female, and that's represented in the music.
Okay. That's a really good answer. I like that. That's very consistent with some of the interpretations that Egyptologists are currently approaching, although they take some more other angles as well. To go back slightly to the music, just my second question. So what does Philip Glass's music, not just the Akhenaten performance, but sort of the music around him as well, what does that tell you about his character and his motivations specifically?
You know, there's this moment in Act 3 where he dies. And of course, we don't know how Akhenaten died, and there's no way for us so far to know. And so
spoilers.
What's amazing, And so what's amazing about opera and art in general is it gives us a lens through which to look at history and human emotions. So in the moment in the opera in which he dies, you have these arpeggios, which are chords broken up, and they're going really fast, like atoms in the air swirling around us with different instruments in the orchestra playing different versions of those scales. And it's a very exhilarating, thrilling experience. And then it might move to a rhythm like ta-ta, pa-pa, pa-pa. And it, with contained within all of those notes is somehow different ideas which the audience can interpret for whether he was killed, whether he died, whether he sort of disappeared. And so I think opera is a perfect way to look at incomplete history and give a representation of it that is narrative and makes sense to a contemporary audience.
Dang, that's a good answer.
Dang.
<Mic drop. laughs>
Yeah,
That's a cool idea, because the ambiguity of Akhenaten perhaps can only be explored today through art, since we can never speak with him. The modern audience can only connect with him through a musical or artistic interpretation.
Well, one thing I realized when I was researching this and going to the British Museum and the Met Museum and talking to these Egyptologists and religion scholars and looking through all these artifacts is that what we know and the story we've constructed in terms of scholarship and history is really constructed by these fragments of art, fragments of things which are in a museum. Similarly, what Philip Glass has done is made his own representation of these fragments and his own version of these little pieces, these little morsels, and it's our job as the performer to connect those dots and to weave a tale and tell a story which gives the audience an emotional connection to this really fascinating subject.
With building on from that, when you and your colleagues are staging the show and you're blocking it out or you're planning your positioning and your movement, how much or how does the material of your character, say like the vocal style and your costume and things, inform how you move on stage? Does he move much, or is he very statuesque and still? How does he actually fill up the stage?
Working with Phelan McDermott, our director, we developed a whole system of atmospheres and ways of being on stage that allow us to at sometimes be very slow, at sometimes be very fast, always to kind of radiate different emotions through our eyes, through our bodies. And so the answer is there's a multitude of Akhenatens that you can see on stage. And I think it's our job as artists to ask questions and not to answer them. So you might come to the opera and I will ask, is Akhenaten good or bad? Is he a cult leader who got everyone to follow his vision? Or was he truly a revolutionary with brilliant ideas trying to change society for the better? Those things are not exactly answered, but with our physicality, with the way we look at each other, with the way we communicate on stage between each other as cast members and also with the audience, you get some sense of that. And it's hard to say until you go into that movie theater or come into this theater and see it what you'll think.
That's great. I look forward to seeing it and to interpreting it for myself. I have my own ideas from history, but I'm looking forward to seeing it brought to life in what is, I know, a wonderful piece of music, but I've never seen it staged, so I'm excited. So, Anthony, that's all my questions for you. So thank you very much.
Thank
Anthony
you.
Roth,
I look
Costanzo,
forward to seeing
Akhenaten.
You. Thanks.
I look forward to seeing your reign in glory on stage.
Ankh, ankh. Okay, thanks very much.
Take care.
My second guest is Janae Bridges, who plays Nefertiti.
Hi, Janae. I'm Dominic.
Hi.
So, Janae Bridges, Nefertiti.
Yes.
Is this your first time performing Nefertiti, or were you also part of the previous runs?
This is actually my second time. I performed it for the first time in 2016 with LA Opera, and Anthony and Zach were also a part of that production. So this is my return to the Queen.
Exciting. And in the time that elapsed, has your interpretation of her changed, or has it evolved in any way?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. Well, I will say that when I first looked at the score, it freaked me out. I'd never sung Philip Glass before, but we had about a month or so of rehearsals with the score, and it steadily became more comfortable vocally, emotionally, and I created my own character. And having 3 years away from it, I would say absolutely yes, it has deepened. My voice has changed, first of all. So it's different in my voice. It feels more settled, actually. I feel like I have more control with pacing. And because I know the opera, I know how it goes, I know how to pace it better. it sits in a better place somehow. And I'm not sure if it's because of my actual physical maturity of my vocal cords or if it's because I now have a deeper understanding of who this character and woman was. I would say that it has definitely deepened emotionally and spiritually for me. on a spiritual level.
Perhaps you've just become accustomed to your throne.
Let's go with that.
Let's go with that. Okay, so in the opera itself, not so much in history, who is your Nefertiti and what kind of characteristics does she bring to the story that's being told on stage?
Another great question. So I've thought about this because that's the beauty of opera. We can take a character and make it our own. And I thought, okay, I don't have an aria in this score, which is interesting. It's truly an ensemble piece. So for me, going into this this opera and this character, Queen Nefertiti, the wife of Akhenaten, and I feel like with that said, I am this figure that obviously everybody knows of, but I'm really kind of the support. Like I am his right hand person. Mm-hmm. This was a very radical thing for them to do, you know, monotheism, and I think that it couldn't have happened actually without a partner of some sorts. So I feel like I am in a way just a part of the glue that has carried this movement.
One of the more popular interpretations these days of the religious scope of these people is that Akhenaten, Nefertiti, and Aten sort of form a divine trinity, with two on earth and one in heaven. So that's actually a really good interpretation of
that. I love that.
Of her role, is that the whole edifice needs her. He can't exist without her, per se.
Yeah. I never thought of that analogy, but yes, that makes a lot of sense. And then Queen Nefertiti historically has been seen as this beautiful woman. Her name actually means beautiful. Beautiful. And so growing up in my household, she was definitely a figure that was represented. And, you know, it was kind of at a time when there wasn't a lot of black representation on on TV or social media. Well, social media wasn't really a thing. But so we have plenty of statues in my home and Ankhs, and I kind of just thought that my parents were weird and my mom was like, I don't know, some spiritual somebody. But I now realize that
she was... If they're weird, I'm weird.
Cool. Weird is not bad, by the way.
No.
It's a good thing. So I grew up with this image of Queen Nefertiti kind of being the ultimate source of womanly beauty. And so I've to be making my Met debut in this role is actually just like I couldn't have imagined anything better. So yeah, I try to access my inner queen, and I really feel like this whole production, the costumes, this house, my colleagues, really bring a sense of royalty to the room, and it's really just easy to go there.
Building on from that, so what does the music itself tell you about her when you listen to it and then when you sort of sing it? What comes through from Philip Glass's notes about this character?
Wow, good question. Well, there is a lot of repetition. Sure. My particular role, that it sits in very strong places of my voice, so I'll sing a million times a E on the staff. And for me, that's like one of the most powerful notes in my voice. So I feel like Philip Glass, he wrote that for a reason, to show that she is a very powerful woman and being. And then during our Act Two duet, Anthony and I, we share a lot of the same notes, and there is this gorgeous legato line that I think kind of makes the whole piece come to a halt, because there's nothing like it in the opera. And it's a moment of, for me, it just feels like ecstasy. It's a moment of beauty and passion and stillness that I think was required for this whole movement, actually. I also think that it's a moment that people walk away with realizing that we just need to be still a little bit, you know, at some point during our day, during our life, just to reflect and drink in the beauty of love, of now.
Maybe we all just need to go outside and sit in the sunlight.
That too, absolutely. I don't know if that answered your question.
It did. Second part of the question, though, is sort of, what sort of sense do you get of her, of Nefertiti's particular motivations or passions from this? Does she have any?
There's a lot, but I honestly feel like I'm motivated to be stronger. Everything in this score musically for me, it's like there's nothing weak about it. And so this role completely inspires me to kind of dig deeper into who I am and who I want to be and what I want to be remembered by. And I think that from what I know of Queen Nefertiti, she's remembered for her physical beauty, but her strength. So I would hope that the audience would notice that as well and hopefully come out, you know, inspired.
Is that a particular challenge trying to bring to life someone who is in many respects a genuine icon, you know, not iconic in the sort of modern colloquialism, but a genuine artistic icon?
I would say no, actually. I mean, maybe yes and no, but for me, I honestly feel like I have Nefertiti in me. Like, I don't know. I feel like I've come from her.
Sure.
So for me, it's really easy to delve into, and I don't feel like I am appropriating. Yes, I don't feel like any of us are doing that because it's rooted in such knowledge and research, and nobody really knows. I mean, Egyptologists don't actually know the truth. So,
correct.
In a lot of this, so I think that what we're bringing to it is as close as you can get, really, to the truth. And who doesn't want to kind of see this come to life in a way? And the arts is, and opera specifically, is such a beautiful form to do that. Nothing, you don't come out with answers. It's like you come out thinking, hopefully, and being inspired. And we're not telling you how to think. Clearly, I'm not Nefertiti, but Nefertiti didn't sing opera. So, I mean, maybe she did. Maybe she did.
That we know of.
So, I don't feel like it's a challenge. I feel like it's actually really rewarding and a gift.
That's good. And that's what you want, essentially. So, building on from that, final question is, how does the sort of material of Nefertiti, the character, like her vocal style, her onstage movement and costume and things, how does all that inform your interpretation of her when you're out there on stage?
Well, Phelan McDermid he's incredible. He's set such a tone for this whole process. But without spoiling too much, I mean, we are in this, often in a setting which we like to call molding. Within the molding, you find moments that of strength. You find moments that are super uncomfortable and exposed. But at the end of the day, for me, they really come down to, it informs, again, I keep saying strength, but it's like you have to press through those uncomfortable moments and you have to continue to radiate and bring these characters alive. So the staging, the vocalism of the score, I think it just really represents this world very well. It heightens it. And I can't imagine actually doing it any other way. So yeah, for me, I completely just agree with with all of the artistic choices. And yeah, it helps me to definitely tap into that strength of Nefertiti and the beauty. I feel very queenly, whatever that is. It feels good and right.
So. No, that's excellent. Yeah. That's great. Well, those are all my questions for you. So Janae Bridges, Nefertiti, great royal wife of Akhenaten. Mm. Thank you very much for coming on to talk about your role. And I look forward to seeing you in the performance.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having us. Thank you for having me.
The podcast will return in just a moment with part two of my interviews with the cast of the Met Opera's Akhenaten.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
My third guest is Desela Larosdotter, who plays Queen Ti, the mother of Akhenaten and the wife of Amunhotep III.
Hi, Desela. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Are you excited for the performance? Are you ready? Are you fired up?
I am. I'm very excited, and it's been a wonderful ride the whole rehearsal period, and so yeah, we're ready for this.
Is this your first time playing Queen Ti, or have you also been involved in earlier productions?
Yes, this is my first time playing her, and
exciting.
Yes, it's very exciting.
So, in this early stage of your interpretation, who is Queen Ti to you, and what kind of characteristics does she bring to the story?
Well, I sense her as this. Because you were asking earlier about like what if you had a persona, thinking about some persona, but I'm actually thinking she's like this Wolverine. She takes care of her pack. She's very strong and she can be fierce, but she really takes care of her, you know, her pack. And her husband, I mean, he passes away in the beginning of the opera, but they share this strong connection, and she holds on to that connection throughout the opera. She sees him, she, seeks condolences with him, seeks strength from him still. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so she's very strong, and she wants to take care of her family first and foremost.
I like that. So musically, what kind of character is Queen Ti, and what can you tell us about her?
Musically, I would say the same thing. You can hear it in the music that she shows you that she can be the gentlest of mom, like we see it mostly in the third act. Scene that, you know, the farewell sort of goodbye. But in the second act temple scene, she is throwing just knives and glass at you. I mean, yeah, so it's really challenging vocally, and it shows you she has to be vulnerable and open and just let it all out. She never opens her mouth unless she's speaking with Akhenaten. So she's always on his side. And yeah, that says a whole lot about her, I think.
Mm. Do you think she's motivated to support him because he's her son, or because she believes genuinely in what he's doing?
I think it's because she's his mother.
Mm.
That's how I sense her. Again, this is something perhaps the audience can think about. Mostly, maybe because as I am a mother, this is how I feel, and I feel like because we know historically that Akhenaten was the first pharaoh to be, not photographed, but drawn out with his wife and with the children in his laps, and I must ask. As a mother, where did he get that idea? He didn't just wake up one day and go like, I'm going to be a great dad. You know, it must have come from something. And so I like to believe that Queen Tai and Amunhotep, they probably showed him that this is important. And they had a very special connection. And he wanted that for himself and for his family. So... That's my little story in my head.
That makes sense. If your child decided to start a religion, how would you feel?
I will be 100% behind his back. You know, if it's, I might not go ruining a temple with him, but you know, you never know.
There's always limits to love.
Yeah.
No, that's good. Yeah. Building on that, so. How much for Queen Ti and Amunhotep the Third's relationship? How much did you and Zachary get to explore that musically together?
Well, we didn't. It's Zach is incredible, and he's just so he's incredible. It's been so good to work with him, and we never had to really talk about it. We sort of had this. Communication without words through rehearsals. It's also through, of course, the insatiable, incredible Phelan McDermott. So we didn't have to really talk about it. It's sort of, I feel like we have this, we can talk through sort of inhaling together and exhaling. And so this is how Queen Tai gets advice and strength just by breathing with her husband, and so yeah, it's been a journey without words, really. It's just been felt somehow through music and through what we're doing.
So going back to Queen Ti, is how does the sort of material of the character on stage, like her delivery and her movements and the costumes she wears, how much of those things inform your interpretation of this particular person?
Her costume is, if we start there, it's quite regal. It's not the typical, it's actually, I think Kevin sought out to the English queen for ideas for the costume. Okay. So it's not your typical sort of Egyptian, although it has the gold and all that fabulous fabulousness. And I believe that the tomb of Queen Tai, it did carry a red wig in it. So that actually is a truth, but that's where the red hair came from in this production. She's very regal, she's very strong, she has to keep up appearances, of course, and the movement is, as Anthony and Janae already said, it's we're using all this molding, which we don't really want to give away too much, but it really has a lot of space for interpretation of emotions and for the audience to fill in what we might be interpreting, which I think is very interesting, and it makes it more interesting for the audience, I believe, to have an idea, to create their own idea, and to discuss it afterwards. We do censor Queen Tai as this very statuesque sort of interpretation of a queen. Mm. You know, you have to be there, you have to stand up straight, and you. She's sort of stepping aside already, as her husband is passed and her son is now taking the throne. So now she's sort of secondary in a way, and yet so important, and always standing by her son's side. Mm. So that's really the whole thing, the whole time. And during the temple, she's the one that is by Akhenaten's side in the battle. So she gives nothing back, even when it is dangerous. Mm. And then you will see in the third act again the very soft, motherly side of her.
Mm. Exciting. So those are all my questions for you. So thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Decella Laurasdotter is Queen Tai, and I'm very excited to see your performance when it's broadcast live and I can catch a glimpse.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too.
My final guest is Zachary James, who has a dual role as Amunhotep III and the scribal narrator who contextualizes important events and conveys significant texts drawn from the corpus of ancient Egyptian literature.
Zachary, thank you very much for joining me, and especially thank you for reaching out to organize this conversation.
Well, thanks for having us. It's really fun to chat.
So, Zach, this is not your first time doing this opera, is it? What other productions have you done of Akhenaten before?
This is my fourth time doing it. It's been the same production each time. So we've done it twice in London now, and once in Los Angeles, and now in New York.
Mm, exciting. So you're very familiar with your characters, and you've learned as much as you can about them musically.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of a very unique situation because it is an opera and I'm an opera singer, but it is a completely spoken role. It needs to be timed out with the music. There's huge musical cues that finish each soliloquy. So you kind of have to be a musician in it, but it's a very different thing than doing a Mozart opera or something where everything is scored out completely. So the bulk of the narrative storytelling is in my hands. It's kind of a lot of pressure.
And on that, how much has your interpretation or your approach to these characters evolved over the now four productions you've worked on?
It's evolved quite a bit. Kind of interesting. The first time I did this, the English National Opera premiere in 2016, they were actually looking for a celebrity actor to do the role. And they had asked John Malkovich and, other really interesting people, and no one was available. So this came to me very last minute. So I was given 1 week to learn about 1,600 words of text. So it was kind of a panic. So I was grateful to have the opportunity to do it again 6 months later in LA and have a little more ease in the process. And then 3 years passed. And in that time, there was this luxurious, amount of time for research and to really think about where this text came from, what it means, and a big part of it, because it kind of sounds like archaic text when you first look at it. And similar to your first time experiencing Shakespeare, you might think, what are all these words? But there's this great depth of meaning in all of these moments, and I really have to peel back the layers and get down to the heart of what's being said. So now doing this for the fourth time, it feels really luxurious. I think it now becomes the show I've done the most in my life. So I feel like I really do know what is going on, but there's a lot to discover. And with each production integrating new artists into it, we have these chances to freshen up the experience and take in what the new artists are giving, and that changes all of us who have done it previously.
Mm. And would I be correct in guessing that each of these productions has been with a different production lead? This time you got Phelim McDermott. Has that been,
yes,
has he been your rock the whole time?
He has, yeah. Phelim has, it's his production. He was approached by Philip Glass to do it. Philip had originally asked him to direct Einstein on the Beach, and Phelim was a bit hesitant because there's this very famous Robert Wilson production, and it just didn't feel like the right time to step away from that moment. But Philip came back and suggested that he direct Akhenaten and Satyagraha, also another one of his operas about Gandhi. So Phelim has been with us for all 3 years now.
Okay, so he's... so he's very much your sort of guru from the composer himself.
Yes, yes. And I actually call him my guru in real life. It makes him blush, but truly, he's a wonderful leader. And this is our eighth production together. So we've been working together for 10 years. And that's kind of how this came to me, was he called last minute and said, "Hey, we're doing this crazy show about Akhenaten. Is there any way you can come to London next week?" And so.
Wow. Actually, just sort of curious on from that, was, has Philip Glass himself been at all involved in these productions, or is he a hands-off kind of person?
He likes to come in kind of later in the process and see what we've done with it. I've done another Philip Glass opera called The Perfect American, which is about Walt Disney. Philip kind of likes to look at complicated, you know, leaders and figures in history and explore them. So that was a world premiere, and Philip was very hands-on in the room because it had never been sung before. But this, you know, they know it's a great work. It's been done, you know, in the 80s. And so he's let us explore it. And then he came in at the last minute and came to opening night in London. And he came to opening night in LA as well. And I'm sure he'll be here at the Met with us for opening.
That's good. That's exciting.
Yeah.
So Amunhotep III only appears in the story very briefly at the beginning, and then sporadically on stage, as I understand it.
Well, I'm on stage. The show's 3 hours, and I'm on stage for 2 hours and 45 minutes. So I'm pretty much there the whole time. But it's an interesting concept that Phelim McDermott, our director, set up, that I start the show and remain on stage the entire show, serving as both a narrator to the audience and delivering these soliloquies and speeches that tie the story together, but also rooted in these relationships with everyone on stage. So my son Akhenaten, my wife, you know, Queen Tai, and the six daughters of Akhenaten and Nefertiti, you know, those would be my granddaughters. So it's quite powerful because we have these relationships, and that ties everything together.
So just to clarify, you also play the scribal role. So
yes,
do you switch, or is that a separate component?
It's one gesture. So Amenhotep III is the scribe, is the narrator.
So are you quickly taking off crowns and like putting on other hats and?
No, we just stay in the one character.
Sure.
And
sure.
In an interesting way, Amenhotep III is the storyteller. I walk out to the audience, and the very first thing that happens is I give this wonderful speech: "Open are the double doors of the horizon, unlocked are its bolts, you know, clouds darken the sky, the stars rain down." And in this, I'm inviting the audience into the story. And the subtext of it is, I have this wonderful story to tell you. You know, come with me. And I would say every 5 or 10 minutes or so, I'm returning with another speech, some really remarkable text. For example, before Nefertiti and Akhenaten's great love duet, I speak these words, love poem, I believe that was found in a tomb. "I breathe the sweet breath which comes forth from thy mouth. I behold thy beauty every day." And it goes on. But these gorgeous words that really tie the story together, because it's very typical of Philip Glass. There's not a lot of words. The singers are mostly singing on vowels. They sing ah, ah, ah. So it's the words that were given to Amenhotep III that tie the story together.
So building on from that, What does Philip Glass's music itself tell you about your character of Amunhotep III? What is his? Do you get a sense of his motivations or his beliefs, or is he rather distant, I might imagine?
I think he's actually very involved, and the music paints the emotional landscape of the character. It's quite fascinating to have the show open with Amunhotep III's funeral, and then to have me remain on stage and watch Akhenaten tear down everything I built, you know, because, of course, Amunhotep III, his reign was so powerful and made Egypt this world power, and things were going very well. And then to stay, present and watch Akhenaten just tear down everything is kind of extremely heartbreaking. And then, I don't want to give too much away, but towards the end of the show, the way Akhenaten's death is represented, the end of his reign, he dies in my arms, kind of like the Pietà. And it's this gorgeous moment, but a very torn moment, because there's this great love for my son, but also he destroyed everything I built. And it's kind of like family, very complicated.
That makes sense. So this is a slightly complicated question for you, since you're on stage the entire time, but how do your sort of onstage movements and blocking and things, how do they inform your interpretation of the character, and what are they conveying to the audience?
Yeah, I kind of think of it like dance. It's a very slow motion dance, and within that there is room for very large gestures, which is really elegant. So if we're expressing anguish, I might have my arms raised all the way to the sky in a very dramatic gesture, but the timing of that, within this world we've set up, it's allowed to take forever. And so doing these extraordinarily large emotional gestures, but over maybe one gesture takes 5 minutes to fully complete. That's how slow we're going. And so within that, there's a long emotional journey and many layers, really. One thing we were talking about when Akhenaten dies in my arms, Phelim, our director, was saying, it can't just be sad. There has to be joy in it as well, because that is life, and there's many emotions in every moment. And so he's dead in my arms, but I'm saying, the sun of him who knew thee not has set, which is a good thing, basically, because we can return to order, we hope.
And I suppose when he, for Amunhotep III, when Akhenaten dies, he's really coming to join him in the afterlife. So it's a loss of legacy, but at the very least he gets that relationship returns to him.
Yeah. And one of the most complex, heartbreaking moments of the entire opera is at the very end. We flash forward to the present and see that there's nothing left of any of this, and that is I think it's really smart that Philip Glass wrote it that way, just to say, how saturated and intense this moment was, and now it's just rubble in the desert.
And yet, ironically, by the mere fact that the opera exists, Akhenaten is more famous than any of these other people, yes, including Amunhotep III.
Exactly, and we resurrect
the beautiful irony.
Yeah, it's quite touching.
So going back to the idea of perhaps Amunhotep III and his relationship with his son. In the opera, do you interact with Queen Ti plenty, but do you interact with Akhenaten at all?
Yes.
Apart from that last scene.
Yes, quite a lot, actually. We make long, extended passages of eye contact and kind of exchange energy in a beautiful way. Following my funeral is Akhenaten's coronation, and I'm very present in that scene. And before he ascends the staircase to the window of appearances, we have a beautiful exchange where I'm kind of passing the throne to him. And it's very touching, kind of a very tender father-son relationship that I think is interesting to explore, and against stereotypes.
Do you think the people coming out of this opera will gain a new appreciation for the difficulties of Akhenaten's reign, specifically what the legacy he inherited, or is it very much more of a sort of personal between two people kind of relationship?
I think Akhenaten's a very sympathetic character in the way it's been written. So I think you kind of understand him, and he was just doing what he thought was best. That he had this great idea, and he thought it was best, but he just was not a good leader. And that's one moment we see in Act 3 of the opera. There's the Tell All Amarna letters, where we have these five letters that I recite, and it's just the people are saying, we have been writing to you for 17 years, and you have never replied meeting any of our needs. We are dying out here. And that's where you really see the turmoil of Akhenaten's kingdom, and that things are just not going well, because we see this beautiful family life with Akhenaten and Nefertiti and the six daughters and Queen Ti. But outside of that, things are going disastrously. And so that's kind of the turmoil of the opera and what happens right before his demise.
That's interesting, because the opera itself was obviously released in the early 1980s and very much at a time when Akhenaten's legacy was being re-examined in those respects. So that's a really... bringing up the Amarna letters is particularly quite interesting in that context.
Right.
So that brings me to the end of the questions I wrote, and it looks like we're right on the cusp of our time. So Zachary James, Amunhotep III, and scribal presence on stage in Akhenaten, thank you very much for joining me and speaking about your character.
Thank you for having us.
Are you excited for the opening of the show? Are you ready, or is this old news to you by now?
Oh, we're ready. The Metropolitan Opera is a dream, and everyone in this room, in this interview, this is where we've wanted to be our whole lives. So it's quite a beautiful moment to share.
That brings us to the end of my interview with the cast of Akhenaten, a Met opera production opening on November 8th. I hope you've enjoyed this discussion, and if you're in New York, consider going to see the opera, which promises to be a spectacular production well worth seeing live. If you can't make it there, look up at your local cinema to see if there'll be a Met Opera recording playing in the forthcoming months. That's all from me. Have a great week, and I'll see you soon for the next episode of the History of Egypt podcast.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a historian, professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that provides a complete overview of U.S. history through storytelling, yet keeps the rigor you'd expect in a university class. Starting with 22-year-old George Washington in his first battle, join me for a chronological telling of the United States' story, its unlikely revolution, fractious civil war, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way through the progressive era. Find History That Doesn't Suck wherever you get your podcasts.